46 Racine, 45 Kenosha, 43 for Burlington, Elkhorn, and Lake Geneva. For WGTD News, I'm Dave McGrath. 10 past 8, the morning show with Greg Berg is next.
Support for the morning show comes from the Carthage College Office of Continuing Studies, providing graduate and accelerated certification programs in education to start or advance a career in teaching. Convenient evening and summer courses are designed for the working adult. More information is available at carthage.edu/grad. And we welcome you to the Tuesday morning show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. Today's interview is from the Morning Show Archives, an interview from about a decade ago. Well, it's always really a bit of a challenge, an interesting challenge, when in a radio program we're going to talk about a book that is almost entirely made up of pictures. And yet we've done it before successfully, and I have a feeling we will do so again today. At least I hope this conversation ends up enticing you to seek out a really fascinating book, a picture book, a book of photographs called Armed America, Portraits of Gun Owners in Their Homes. The man responsible for it is Kyle Cassidy, a well-known fashion photographer and portrait photographer. His work has appeared in all kinds of different places, and he has a very interesting photo of the week blog at kylecassidy.com. And in this book, we see photographic images, one at a time, of gun owners in their own homes, and very brief words of explanation about why they have chosen to own guns. And it is a thoroughly fascinating book. And depending on where you stand on the issue of gun ownership and gun control, you may find this book exhilarating and inspiring or troubling or thought-provoking, or any number of responses might indeed be possible. Again, the book is called Armed America, Portraits of Gun Owners in Their Home. And it's a Krauss publication. And Kyle Cassidy, we welcome you to the morning show.
Thank you, Greg. It's good to be with you. I wanted to mention really quickly, if people want to sort of watch along while we're talking, they could go to the website, which is armedamerica.org, and they can see some of the photos there and some of the text.
What a terrific idea. I'm glad you you mentioned that. So this, judging from the very brief bio of you on the book jacket, this would seem to be, at least at a glance, to be quite a departure for you professionally from the work that you have typically done. Tell us a little bit about that idea, that initial idea, and if it indeed is as marked a departure from your normal routine as it might appear to us.
It is. It's a lot different than what I normally do. A lot of the photos that I do professionally are kind of fantastical photos, in that there are maybe absurd elements, and there's a lot of humor in my images. And I usually exert a lot of control over what's going to be in the final product. And in this project, I was actually trying to remove myself as much as possible from what was being seen. I didn't want to intrude at all into these images. I wanted to show the insides of people's houses without my own thoughts and ideas interjected into it. And that's pretty much diametrically opposed to what I've been doing normally in the past.
Why gun ownership? Why that particular facet? I mean, you could have filled a book with images of people that own cats or own swimming pools or own fancy stereo equipment. Why gun ownership?
Yeah, it actually seems after doing this that the the group of people probably would have been relatively similar. I've been thinking if I'd photographed people with rocking chairs, I probably would have had the same political mix-up that ended up in this one. About 3 years ago, and at the end of 2004, I was at a dinner party, and I was seated next to a man who was a former presidential campaign staffer, and the election had just ended, so it was on everybody's mind, and I'd never met a presidential campaign staffer before, so over the course of dinner, I was grilling him about what he did, and one of his multitudinous jobs, he mentioned, was to help wrangle the gun vote, which really fascinated me because I'd never thought about the gun vote. In fact, I hadn't really thought much about guns. And apparently political candidates spend an awful lot of time thinking about the gun vote and how to appeal to gun owners. And I realized that I had only the vaguest idea of who these people were. I live in West Philadelphia, which is a very urban environment, and we don't have any deer hunters here to speak of, or things like that. And apart from the evening news, when you hear that a drug dealer shot another drug dealer somewhere in North Philly, you don't really hear much about guns, and not many people around here that I knew had one.
Well, and politicians are not going for those votes. I mean, of drug dealers in Philadelphia, that's obviously not what they're talking about.
That's true. And I wanted to meet the people who own guns, the people that these politicians were talking about. I wanted to see what they looked like, how they lived, what their lives were like. And I wanted to know why so many people had so many guns. So I thought, well, wouldn't it be great to drive across the country and meet gun owners and ask them one question: why do you own a gun? And that's what the book is. It's a photo of a person or a family in their home surrounded by the stuff that they live with, which I think tells us a lot about who we are. If you look at my bookshelves, you'll learn a lot about me and the videos that I have and the magazines that are on my coffee tables and things like that. So I wanted to photograph these people in that environment, ask them that question, and not interject myself and my own beliefs and ideas about gun ownership into the picture at all, and let them tell their story without any influence from me.
Now, I was trying to sort out from the introduction to the book, which is very, very well written and a nice, intriguing beginning to it all. Although one of the things I like about it is it leaves certain things a little bit unanswered.
Mm-hmm.
For instance, you talk a lot in the introduction about West Texas. Mm-hmm. I mean, ultimately, do all these pictures come from gun owners in West Texas?
No. I started out in West Texas, and that had I actually started out in California, but the first part of that trip had a big impact on me. And I didn't want to write an introduction to the book. I just wanted to have it just these people and their comments. And my publisher insisted that I write something, and I didn't want to write anything about guns, so I wrote about the trip.
Mm.
And West Texas, I was in West Texas in July in a car with no air conditioner. And it was, for me, a lot of this book was seeing America. All this book was seeing America, an America that I'd never seen before. I'd never been in the desert in West Texas, let alone in July in a car with no air conditioning. So that had an impact on me. The geography of America had an impact on me as much as the people that I met had an impact on me. I met people in Massachusetts and people in Florida and people in Kentucky and people in West Texas.
Now, if I understood correctly, the project began with more of a studio look, gun owners being photographed in that kind of setting. And
yeah,
then I think at some point you made the decision that was just maybe too sterile and too generic, and you wanted something that was a little more authentic. Is that right?
Yeah. My first photos, the first iteration of this was thinking, I'll just get people in the studio and I'll light them real nice and I'll have a book and all these portraits will look the same except for their answers, which will be different. And looking at it, I had a bunch of really nicely lit portraits that told no story whatsoever. And I realized that I wasn't any closer to learning who these people were, and I was going to have to go back and start all over again doing the photos in people's houses. And I think that was a real breakthrough for me, that realization. And I think that if I had continued photographing people in the studio, I would have had a book that was never published. I might have had a gallery show out of it. But I think its appeal was very limited.
So how did you end up connecting with these people and getting in the front door and actually into their homes. Explain the logistics of that.
Yeah, that was really difficult at first. I had this naive idea that I'd just be able to walk into a gun store and say, hey, I'm an objective journalist, and I'd like to do this objective piece about gun owners. Can you hook me up with some? And gun owners are, by nature, suspicious, and probably more suspicious of the media. They have a feeling that they've been burned in the past, and they're reticent to talk. So it took me a long time to build up people's trust and convince them that I wasn't trying to do a hatchet job on their culture, their way of life. And once I got a few portraits, 5, 6, 7 portraits, I could show them to people, and they could see immediately what I was trying to do, and that got a lot easier. So once it started, it really caught on. And I also gave everybody I photographed copies of their pictures, and I said, you can do whatever you want with this. You can, you know, hang it on your fridge. You can make a Christmas card out of it. You can post it on your website, and you can email it to all your friends. And that's what happened. These people who were inside the gun culture started emailing pictures to each other, and they were showing up on gun forums on the World Wide Web. And so I would get calls from people who would say, hey, if you're ever through Missouri, you know, I'd really love to be in your book. So I would write down this person's name and address and stick a pin in a map of America. And when I could cross the country from coast to coast by connecting the dots of these pins, I called people along that route and said, hey, I'm going to be in your town in 3 weeks. Can you find me 5 friends? And so when I would roll into town, I'd have a list of phone numbers to call of people who are interested in being in it. And it always seemed that right after I went through a place is when it really exploded. You know, I'd get back from Kentucky, and, you know, 3 days later, 100 people would call me and say, hey, are you going to be in Kentucky?
And you would have already been there.
Already been, yeah. Leaving this trail of interest behind me.
So the buzz was always just trailing a little bit behind you. But
yes,
you wouldn't have had room for all of those interested people anyway.
I should have had 2 cars. Yeah, that's true.
We're speaking with Kyle Cassidy, and we're talking about a very interesting book of photographs he has released called Armed America, Portraits of Gun Owners in Their Homes. So once you are in the front door of these various homes and apartments, then what was the process like in which certain decisions were made about what room to choose and how the people should be posed and what sort of personality to convey? Were those decisions that these various gun owners made and you simply recorded their choices? Or were you a part of some of those choices as well?
Well, it depended. Portraiture is always a collaboration between a photographer and a subject. And some people I would show up at their house, and they will have arranged things in a particular way. And specifically, they would have put their guns in a certain place. And I often went with that because I thought that was part of their personality, too, how they wanted to display something. And there were a lot of people who just said, well, I'm your canvas, do whatever you want. So I would walk around the house, and I would look for something that I thought was iconic of their story, that told something interesting about them, where they collected, you know, beer cans or glass baubles or whatever. And I would set up that way with something, some interesting visual element in the background, and pose them that way. There was a family in Oregon who had cleaned out a room of their house and made it absolutely Spartan. It was, there are 2 chairs and a gun in there. And I took a couple pictures, and I said, you know, this really isn't your story. I'd rather photograph you in the, you know, the living room downstairs. And they're like, oh, the living room's a wreck. And I said, yeah, you know, but I think since you pushed everything out of this room into the hall, I think that tells more of your life story.
And by and large, I guess this is where trust comes in, that mm-hmm. people needed to trust that you were not trying to do something that would ridicule their lifestyle or their life choices or the fact that they owned guns. I mean, there are several different ways this could have been done. The same sort of thing could have been done, but it could have been done entirely with the purpose of ultimately sort of poking fun at gun owners or painting them in a certain way. So how is it that these gun owners, many of whom, as you sort of suggested, are by nature distrustful of the media, and maybe understandably so, how is it that they came to trust you as they did?
Yeah, that's absolutely true. Your observation that it could have been used pejoratively, and I was very aware of that when I was taking the photos, and I was very concerned that the people realized that I had no intention of doing that. And I had a photography professor once years ago who taught me that the most important aspect of photography is not shutter speeds and apertures and knowing what lenses to use. It's being able to talk to people, and that's the most important thing. And one of the things that I liked about this project is that it was so challenging in some ways, and I think it really helped me to grow as a photographer to be able to talk to people. And I came out of it a better person than when I went in. I think sincerity has a lot to do with it. And I spent a lot of time researching, too. I subscribed to every gun magazine I could find, and I read every single issue cover to cover so that I could talk to people about things that were important to them.
And different kinds of guns, I suppose, and so on.
So that, you know, when I would pull into somebody's house, I would have the vocabulary, you know, to talk about the things that interested them. And it has a lot to do, I believe, with listening, too. I didn't talk very much while we were doing this. I listened to what other people had to say, and I think a lot of people have a story they want to tell, and they're looking for somebody to listen to it.
Right. I think one thing that's really interesting, as we just, even at a very quick glance through some of the images in your book, is that there will be some images, for instance, Dan on page 60, Dan from Pennsylvania, sits there, you know, in a fairly empty room, except for a pile of pizza boxes in the corner, but otherwise on what looks like a futon. And on the table before him are all these pistols. And then four big rifles, and that's all we see, and we get the sense from that Dan is a gun owner, and that is all we're going to know about Dan. Versus the very first image in the book, page 8, a couple from someplace in Wisconsin, and they're posing, man and wife, with the cat on the husband's shoulder. And we can see out the windows of their living room, and we see some of their furniture. And to the side of them, over on the phone, are a lot of guns, but they're kind of off to the side. And it's we see more than the guns. I mean, you understand what I mean? It seems like in some of these images, there's a real centrality to the guns themselves. Mm-hmm. And in others, it's just like one more something that's in the room, that's in the house, almost an incidental presence.
Yeah, Dan is a gun hobbyist, and that's pretty much his hobby. I don't know that he, you know, plays Xbox or rides a BMX bike or, you know, goes to a lot of concerts, but he's really into guns. And his apartment was pretty sparse. I don't think there's anything hanging on his walls. You know, there's a few pieces of furniture. There was a sofa, and there was a TV, and that was pretty much it. Whereas Rob and Cicely, their house was, I think their gun ownership was more incidental to their lives. They went shooting a lot, I believe, but they were interested in other things. I know that Cicely was a big cook, and she likes to do things like that. And it has to do with, A, how you decorate your house. Some people don't have a lot of decoration in their house, I've discovered, and how important, how central the issue of guns is to you, and how much you, well, there's some people who are really interested in guns and don't have a lot of guns, but they spend a lot of time thinking about it.
There are a few images that I think for the vast majority of people, and certainly not all, would be really troubling images, in that they are gun owners who seem to be the sort of people that, if the federal government came a-knocking for whatever reason, they would probably barricade themselves in their home or apartment and fight them off as desperately as possible. I mean, there are several images in the book that do more than suggest that. And even one image, I can't find it now, in which the young man in question has a bandana over his face. But what was it like for you to be in the homes of people like that? And were you able to maintain the kind of cool professional objectivity that you were just talking about, even in the presence of somebody like that?
I was very grateful to be invited into every house that I was invited in, and I was very curious about people's lives, and I was very lucky to be able to hear their stories. I didn't think that anybody was going to shoot me or tie me up in the basement or anything like that, and I think that the images that you're talking about are the people who might have a more extreme story than others. For me, were possibly the most interesting ones, because I could have stayed in Pennsylvania and photographed deer hunters until I dropped dead. But I wanted to meet different types of people. And I was more excited meeting people who had a story that I hadn't heard before, and realizing that I was getting another facet of this multifaceted part of America. So I actually really enjoyed those.
One person that makes kind of an interesting point, I mean, besides some of the other more commonly heard rhetoric from gun owners, is someone named Howard in Pennsylvania. And we probably see more guns in his photograph than we do in any others. On page 70 of the book, his walls are literally covered with carefully mounted rifles. And he says, "I love history and I love old mechanical devices. Guns are both." It never occurred to me that might be one reason why at least some people are so fascinated by guns and drawn to them.
Yeah, that's something that I heard from several people. And Howard's actually on the website, too. If people want to check out armedamerica.org, they can see his picture up there. I think he's got 40 or 60 guns or something like that in that room. And they're all very meticulously, as you said, arranged and hung on the wall. And Howard's a collector. He's a serious collector. And I think he exhibits a lot of the personality traits that you see in people who collect, Barbie dolls or Star Wars figures or, whatever else people collect. He gets a great deal of enjoyment from arranging and looking at his collection, and he's got it on display in a really museum-like way, almost.
Something also intriguing, here and there in the book, we will see an image that really surprises us a lot. There will be somebody who might be fairly elegantly dressed, someone who might look like they're, a college professor or something like that. And they will be standing there, maybe in a lovely living room or in their dining room, but they're holding a gun, or there's a gun on the table beside them. And and it's such a shocking image to see that. We just don't expect it.
Yeah, I was really surprised at the diversity of people who ended up in this book. I had this vague idea going into it that a gun owner was a guy in a beat-up pickup truck with a dirty baseball hat and a Bush Cheney sticker on the back. And that turned out not really to be the case. I certainly met people like that, but they don't fill the entire book, and they weren't everybody that I met. And I don't even think that they were the preponderance of people that I met. And when my assistant and I were driving across the country, I used to look out the window and the next car over in the traffic light and say, he's got a gun, or he doesn't have a gun. And the more we photographed, the more we met people, the more I realized that you can't do that. That you can't look at somebody on a street corner and figure out just by their looks if they're a gun owner or not.
I mean, that certainly is something we learn in your book, if we learn nothing else. At the risk of a vast generalization or oversimplification, it does seem like if there's anything that is common here, it is that we don't see a lot of wealth on these pages. But maybe people were taking you into the humbler rooms of their homes. But we see in many, many cases is relatively sparse living conditions, or very, very humble living conditions, but people who have nonetheless somehow found room in their budget to buy themselves a gun and maybe many guns. Do you think that's fair, or is there more money behind some of these images than we might guess?
It's you know, it's middle class America. There's some upper middle class America and some lower middle class America, but it's it seems pretty much straight across shot of middle class America. And some place, and then there were two lawyers that I photographed in their attic because they had a children's playroom up there. So, you know, their house might look a little like it has tiny furniture in it. And there were actually a few lawyers in there, and there's a doctor who's in a nursing home. So his conditions probably look sparser than his bank account.
Right, right. What was your main purpose in doing this? Was it simply to satisfy some sort of inner curiosity of your own that you thought might be the curiosity of others as well? Or is there a message behind this book as well?
I started out completely because I was interested in knowing this. And somewhere along the way, it turned into something that I realized could be a more exciting project and an actual product. I realized that this could turn into a book, and that affected it, but it didn't. It didn't really change the motivation of it. It made me do it better, and it gave me a tighter deadline for doing it, which ultimately I think really helped. But the main reasoning behind it, which was me trying to find out why so many people owned so many guns, never changed from the beginning to the end.
So you feel like in terms of the words people spoke and the explanations they gave, that there is a lot to learn there?
Yes, there are a lot of questions that are answered, but I think it also asks a whole lot of more questions, and hopefully it begins a dialogue, and a dialogue rather than a shouting match. I think for the past few years, there are two opposing sides on the gun debate, and I don't think they've talked to each other. And I think they spend a lot of time waving signs at each other from opposite sides of the street. And I think that this might be a starting place for some people to sit down and have conversations over a coffee table or in an art gallery somewhere. And I think that would be a nice thing, a nice message that people can discuss things.
Do you anticipate doing either a sequel to this book, or could you imagine yourself, or maybe for all I know, you're already at work on maybe a future volume that is the same sort of thing, but not about gun owners?
Yeah, I'd actually cross my mind, like, I should photograph people who own rocking chairs now. I don't know how well that would sell. I'm actually working on a book right now of war veterans and their tattoos that memorialize their service somehow.
Wow.
Because it's, you know, it's sort of the same thing, that I'm meeting people and I'm hearing their stories, and those stories are interesting, and I'm interested in subcultures, and tattoos are certainly a part of a subculture, and people who would use their sort of body as a diary or a journal to write, to memorialize events that were important to them. And those stories, if it's worth putting on your arm or your chest, especially if you did it in 1942, those stories are interesting, and I think somebody should be writing them down.
Well, certainly this was an interesting book for me to see. It came in the mail, and I found it quite interesting, but didn't have the time to really look carefully. And then when I was on vacation in Washington, D.C., I went into a bookstore there, and your book was prominently displayed. And somehow picking it up in a bookstore, it had even more impact for me. I mean, I took it seriously and really took a look at it and thought, oh, my gosh, Kyle Cassidy is someone I want to talk about. I want to talk to him about this book, and I am glad we had this opportunity. The book, again, is called Armed America, Portraits of Gun Owners in Their Homes, a Krauss publication. And Kyle Cassidy, I thank you so much for putting together this thoughtful, fascinating book and for joining me today on The Morning Show to talk about it.
Thank you so much. It's been wonderful to talk to you.
And we're going to follow up with Kyle Cassidy with a couple of additional questions, which actually occurred to me fairly long after we'd hung up the phone and our conversation had finished, and I appreciate his interest in coming back on the line now about a week later to explore just a couple of other things about this very interesting story, and again about the book called Armed in America. Kyle Cassidy, this is this one question actually was inspired by a friend of mine who was paging through this book and very intrigued with it. She saw it at our house, and they asked a question which I wish I had asked in our interview, and that is, aren't some of these guns illegal? I think she was reacting to some of the photographs which show very, very formidable-looking machine guns that look like sort of semi-automatic weapons, and depending on where one lives, it might be that some of these are weapons that are really illegal to possess. Did you get into that very much with any of these people who you photographed? What can you tell us about that?
Well, first of all, I wanted to say I'm glad that you took the book home and that people are looking at it and people are talking about this important issue. I didn't specifically ask people about the legality of their gun collections. However, I did offer from the very beginning to keep anybody anonymous who didn't want to reveal who they were or where they lived in the book. And I wanted to actually not know if people had illegal guns because I didn't want to be put in the position where I would be called upon to divulge something about them. There was only one person who actually took me up on the offer of anonymity, who you can see in the book wearing a bandana around his face. And another thing that I learned as somebody coming from outside the gun culture is that the appearances can be deceiving. In the way that a Pontiac Firebird looks like a Chevrolet Corvette, there are many guns that look like military weapons or look like fully automatic weapons that aren't. And I think one of the best examples in the book is Dan. I can't remember what page the book Dan's on, but he's also on the website at armedamerica.org. And Dan has two rifles sitting on his sofa that look identical to the casual observer. In fact, to somebody who is an expert in weapons, they would look identical. One of them happens to be a fully automatic machine gun, the M16, which is what the U.S. military uses. And the other one is the civilian version of it, the AR-15, which is a semi-automatic gun. And they look identical. And the only way to tell if one is fully automatic is actually to either fire it or to take it apart and look at the insides of it. And hopefully that answers some of your questions.
Absolutely. Oh, very good. One of the things we talked about in the balance of the main interview was how you were interested in knowing who are gun owners, and when politicians are going after the gun vote or gun voters, I mean, who in fact are we talking about? And what we see in the pages of your book, of course, is this amazing array of human beings from all walks of life, in all shapes and sizes and colors and so on, various economic groups and so on. I mean, it's a wide spectrum, a much wider spectrum than a lot of people would assume who are from the outside looking in at, as you call it, the gun culture. I wonder, however, these pictures in your book, how representative, in fact, are they? Is this a wider array than, in fact, there actually is in the gun culture? I mean, or are a lot of the folks who own guns and prize guns of sort of a narrower slice, plus, of course, others that create this variety? Do you understand what my question is?
Yeah.
I guess ultimately the question is how you chose these particular people to be in the pages of your book, and what should we take away from the wide spectrum that we see there?
Yeah, you ask a very intelligent question, and certainly this is an unscientific sample, and I don't even know how to make a scientific sample of something like this. I'm not a social scientist by profession. I don't have a degree in social sciences, so I wouldn't even really begin to know about how to verify whether or not this is a representative sample. Certainly the sample is self-selective. These are all people who were willing to be photographed with their weapons in their houses. There were people on polar sides of the spectrum who didn't want to be photographed for a variety of reasons. There were a lot of people who, for want of a better term, I will call liberal, who didn't want their friends and neighbors to know that they were part of this community because it had a pejorative connotation to it in terms of the people that they surrounded themselves with on a day-to-day basis. And at the opposite end of the spectrum, there were people who were concerned that the government was going to find out that they had guns and somehow begin a process of taking guns away from people. And for that reason, they wanted to keep their gun ownership under the radar. So at these two extremes, there were people who weren't interested in being in it. And there were other people, middle-class African-Americans, for example, were also very reticent to be in it because they didn't want to either participate in sometimes or reinforce a stereotype that young black males are armed, for example. So they were all difficult people to convince and maybe underrepresented in my book as compared to the real spectrum of gun owners.
Hmm.
Something else that I think is important is that I've come to believe that the view of who gun owners are is politically important for some people to project in a particular way, whether it's pro-gun people or anti-gun people, to say these people are gun owners. And I believe that the answer to the question who makes up the panorama of gun owners, I believe that that question is clouded, perhaps intentionally, by many people who are involved in the debate about guns in America.
Hmm.
So I don't know that how to even begin finding out the real answer to your question.
Right. I guess, and I appreciate that the honesty of that answer and the clarity of it. I guess part of what this comes down to is you wanting to create as interesting a book as possible and as visually arresting as possible. And if, in fact, you had filled your book with picture after picture of what some people would describe as the stereotypical gun owner in America. I mean, kind of a stereotypical idea which you yourself shared at the beginning of this interview with us. That would be kind of a boring book, probably.
It's certainly true that I could have stayed in Pennsylvania and photographed deer hunters until I died of old age. And because of the geographic diversity and the geographic reasoning behind a lot of people's gun ownership, I felt compelled to move from where I was and to meet people in other places. And this was one way that was my attempt to get the most broad spectrum possible of gun owners in America. Go ahead.
I have one further question that I didn't warn you about, but it also pops in my head. Was there anything else you wanted to say about that particular question?
I think we hit that pretty well.
Very good. A last thought then. I wonder, through the course of this experience, and maybe you could remind us also over what span of time it took place. I mean, from the time you got the idea to the time you finished this book, over the span of whatever time that was and since the release of the book, has your attitude about guns and the whole issue of right to bear arms and so on, has that been significantly altered by this experience?
To start at the beginning, I got this idea in December of 2004, November of 2004, and worked on it sporadically for the next few months. Like any artist, I think you pick up a project and you pick up a multitude of projects and you work on them bit by bit, and some of them grow into something that wants more attention and the other was sort of fall to the wayside. And by about that time the next year, which was December of 2005, it became obvious to me that this was going to be something that was big, and I started to put a lot more time and effort into it. At the very beginning of this, I had not spent much time around firearms, and certainly my first trip to the gun range was a little unsettling, and that could have been because of maybe there was a taboo that I had culturally about being in a place like that. And so it felt strange to me, and also it was dimly lit, and you know, there was an atmosphere to it that seemed somewhat sinister. And as the years have gone past and I have been exposed to guns certainly more, my reaction to guns has become a lot different. And this is probably the same experience that someone would have who
who worked in an emergency room or who worked in a hospital somewhere, that the things that were shocking to me at first, I became desensitized to. And meeting a lot of people, I think, got me more, certainly a better idea of what the gun culture was, or at least the gun culture that I had discovered was. As you pointed out before, it might not be actually representative, but the people that I met were people who invited me into their houses and people who opened up their lives to me and people who, to some not insignificant degree, trusted me. And I think with that trust comes some sympathy on my part. I'm grateful to these people for letting me into their lives. And because of that, and because they were willing to talk to me, I think I heard more, certainly, than I would have heard if I had just stayed home and continued watching TV, you know, the rest of my life, as many of us do.
Kyle Cassidy, photographer and responsible for this very intriguing photograph book called Armed in America. Kyle Cassidy, I very much appreciate you giving me a bit of extra time, and I thank you again so much for joining me today on The Morning Show.
Not at all. It's wonderful to have been here.
And just to clarify, I misspoke at the very end of that interview. The title of Kyle Cassidy's book is Armed America. Armed America. It's 8:51. You're listening to the Tuesday Morning Show on WGTD.
We are about to learn about an intriguing undertaking by New York Times bestselling author Dan Buettner, who had studied some of the most long-lived persons around the world, different places around the world where people are able to live longer lives than one otherwise might expect. And Dan Buettner has followed up on that intriguing study with a study of some of the places around the world where people seem to be particularly happy. And of course, this is a matter that is not quite as easily studied or quantified, but he has undertaken this study nevertheless. Dan Buettner is a pioneer when it comes to the matters of exploration and education and understanding humankind a bit better. And this book comes to us from National Geographic. And his previous book about longevity was called The Blue Zones and was a bestseller. Dan Buettner, we welcome you to The Morning Show.
Well, let me just say I'm happy to be here.
You tell us that this is a really different matter. I mean, in some ways related, but it's a very different thing to be doing a serious study about happiness.
Yes.
Tell us just how tricky, in fact, this has been for you.
Well, okay, so for longevity, you find an area where there are a lot of 100-year-olds. You can count 100-year-olds and you can see them. But for happiness, you can't just look at a person and know for sure if they're happy. So we worked with three enormous databases, the Healthways Gallup Well-Being Index, the World Value Survey out of the University of Michigan, and the World Database of Happiness, I love that name, out of Rotterdam. And they were able to, tens of millions of surveys, they were able to tell us the happiest region of the happiest country on each of four continents. And the way that's done is they essentially ask people on a scale of 1 to 10, they do it very carefully and methodically, how happy are you? And as a rule, people report accurately, and there are enormous variances. There are places around the world where the average score is a 3, and then you go to Aarhus, Denmark, the happiest place in the world we found, and you have a score of 8.5 out of 10. So you know people are happy there. Hmm. And then we learn their lessons.
And you have ultimately traveled to these different places to see what you could learn about their particular experiences. The first place you talk about is a place in Denmark. And it's really interesting, especially when you sit across the table from someone studying this who sort of struggles with the very definition of happiness and tries to get at the heart of why these particular Danes, and many Danes for that matter, are so very happy. Just say a word about that exchange. That really gives us a sense of the whole book and this whole study.
So a lot of us think that money and status will buy us happiness, and Denmark teaches us the opposite story. Here's a place where the garbage man makes as much as the lawyer. Now, your health care is taken care of and your education is taken care of, but if you make over a certain amount of money, you'll be taxed at as much as 70%. But what that does, though, is you're not going to try really hard to get a job as a lawyer or CEO. So you have a country that's engaged in furniture design and architecture and niche technology. They work only 37 hours a week, so they're not working at the expense of social interaction. And they trust each other. It's a society of trust and acceptance. You can be of any persuasion, of any ethnicity, and your neighbors will make you feel welcome.
Tell us about the other places you visited and the people you talked to gain further insights on what it means to be happy and how the rest of us can perhaps become happier people.
So we found the happiest place in Asia in Singapore, which people think is Bhutan, but that's a PR whitewash. And among the people I talked to Lee Kuan Yew, who's the prime minister who more or less created that place from a fishing village back in the 60s. And he understood the Asian value set very clearly. He knows that people there like their life neatly laid out for them. I implicitly understood that humans like security more than they do freedom. It's more important that you can walk in the streets and feel safe and let your kids go to playgrounds than it is to be able to buy pornography or to necessarily have all the political freedom in the world. He's set it up so it's very easy to own your own home. He set it up so that there's tax incentive to keep your aging parent living near you, so seniors are better cared for. And it turns out studies show that we get more satisfaction from socializing with our parents than we do just about anybody else.
Tell us about this term thriving. This is something that comes up quite a lot in the book, and it's a term we've all heard, but probably not used in the particular way that you're using it. It sort of takes this discussion and reflection a further step.
Yes. So thrive actually comes from academic literature. A thriving person is somebody who not only sees they're very happy today, but actually sees they're going to be somewhat happier tomorrow. And it's the traditional ways of measuring happiness were simply asking people to rate their happiness on a scale of 1 to 10. But it turns out that we only remember about 3% of our past. We remember the low points and the high points. So we have kind of a skewed assessment of our life when we're asked to remember. The other type of happiness is experienced happiness, moment to moment. How do we experience life? And that's measured in a different way. And it turns out that it's not always the case that people who say they're happy are really happy. Like the millionaire, you might look at his day, and the millionaire says, "Yo, I'm happy with my life," but he's stressed out all day about his job. He's worried about his portfolio. What thriving is not only saying you're happy, but actually experiencing it from day to day. And the book tells you 30 things you can do, evidence-based things you can do, to get to that state.
We're about out of time, but can you quickly share a couple of your favorites and maybe those that would be maybe beyond the usual or the expected?
Yeah, TV was an interesting one. It turns out we do get some happiness from watching TV, but only about an hour a day. So I advocate one TV in the house, put it behind doors, make it an intentional act. When it comes to how you spend your money, financial security has three times the impact on your happiness than income alone does. So instead of buying a bunch of new shoes or the latest big screen TV, fund your retirement, pay down your mortgage, put a little bit of money away. And then the big thing, we know that the happiest people in America socialize about 7 hours a day. So you should be joining clubs and social organizations and volunteering. It's a sure way to impact positively your happiness.
And more insights to be found in this book called Thrive, Finding Happiness the Blue Zones Way. It's from National Geographic. It's author Dan Buettner. Dan Buettner, thank you so much.
It was a delight. Thank you.
Tomorrow on the morning show, from the archives, Isabel Wilkerson and her award-winning book, The Warmth of Other Suns, which examines the enormous migration of black Americans out of the South into other parts of America in the late 19th and early 20th century. And on Thursday, from the archives, John M. Barry's book, The Great Influenza, a look at the catastrophic flu epidemic that